Hello, I'm Richard Ailey. This is Sunday Profile. Today, the man from Tumbarumba, now launching a space business in San Francisco. Chris Boshausen trained as a physicist, and until recently, he worked for NASA. Growing up in Tumbarumba, on the edge of the Snowy Mountains, he'd been obsessed with space and dreamed of going there. After university in Sydney, he went to America and found a job with the most famous name in the space business. Job done, you'd think. But no, a few years ago, he and a couple of other like-minded scientists set up their own business. Planet Labs essentially harnesses technology not a million miles away from the mobile phone to develop satellites, which have already been launched into orbit. His achievements have just won him the Advanced Global Australian Award. But what exactly does he do?
My role is to lead the development of the technology and essentially the design of the spacecraft, how they're used in space and how we get data back down to the Earth.
Right. So what are you putting in space?
Oh, great question. So we are launching the world's largest constellation of Earth-observing satellites. And so these are small satellites that are basically, you can think of them as webcams in space that are going to monitor the entire Earth at medium resolution so that we can learn about things that are happening on the planet.
And how, when you say small, how small are we talking?
Yeah. So most satellites are about the size of a fridge or maybe a car. Ours are the size of a loaf of bread, but they have almost exactly the same capabilities.
How did you come up with the idea?
So previously we had been building what we thought was the cheapest possible satellite. And we cheated with that because we actually took an entire smartphone, an Android smartphone, and put it in a box and put it in space and called it a satellite. But that taught us a lot about how to build cheap satellites.
Because you were working at NASA, weren't you?
That's right, I was, yes.
And this came out of, what, just looking at a phone and thinking, we could use that phone.
Yeah, so we had a mentor by the name of Pete Klupa, one of the senior managers at NASA Ames Research Center. He would often talk at conferences and pull his government-issued BlackBerry out of his pocket. This was even before smartphones, I think. And he'd pull it out and tell the audience, my phone has more capability than most satellites. You know, why are they so damn expensive? But he'd put his phone back in his pocket and then go back to work. And so after about 2 years of hearing this, my friends and I were like, why don't we just build the damn thing? And so we literally started this project called PhoneSat based on Pete's message.
And it almost literally was putting a phone into a small box and sending that small box into space. Is that what it was?
Yeah. So phones are a little inconvenient because they only have one plug. But the first time we did it, we really, you know, wanted to get the message across that a phone could work. So we launched the entire phone, screen and all. No one could see the screen up there, of course. But, you know, we put the entire phone in a box. We had to put it diagonally so it would fit. All we added was some extra batteries and a radio so we could talk to it from the ground.
And what did you want that phone in space? Phone in space, I just love that idea, to be able to do.
So the idea was that it was meant to, I guess, be a in a sense, a spiritual or you know, mental image of the cheapest thing you could do for people to really understand that space was accessible. That phone had more capability than Sputnik, which was launched by the Soviet Union in 1957. And so it's crazy to think that for around, you know, $500 for a phone and about $70,000 to launch it, you know, a kid in their backyard in Australia today could do what the Soviet Union did 40 years ago,
right.
50 years ago.
You'd need $50,000. But still, yeah, that is amazing. So out of that idea and doing that, it essentially led to you thinking, well, we can take this idea further, but to do that, you decided to leave NASA.
Right. I guess the main point of the PhoneSat project, here to your earlier question, was to stimulate the industry and sort of put an anchoring point saying, this is possible, this is the cheapest thing you could do, and so the cheapest thing doesn't have to be $1 billion or $1 million, the cheapest thing could actually be a couple of $1,000s. And so in between that range is a whole bunch of really cool things you can do. We decided to put our money where our mouth is and go out and try that ourselves as well. There have actually been about 10 other companies and student groups around the world that have been inspired by the PhoneSat project and started their own versions as well.
This is part of a wider movement, isn't it? Away from this idea, which has held really for decades, that space is difficult and expensive and the engineering challenges are enormous, and essentially you have to leave it to governments to do it.
Right, that's exactly it, Richard. I think people, you know, never imagined that they'd be able to do space exploration themselves. And it's snuck up on us really quietly, but suddenly you can. You can do something in space. You could put your own phone in space if you wanted to.
I'm not going to do that. But Planet Labs, so you've got this, I'm going to use the word flock, because that's what you call them, of satellites that went up in January and came out and were released into the environment or into space in February, so quite recently.
Right.
What are they going to be able to do?
Yeah, so the flock, as we call it, actually it's kind of nice. Well, the reason why we call it flock is they're actually a flock of doves. Most satellites have really evil names.
Do they?
Yeah.
Like what?
Like Hawkeye or something like that, right? And, you know, birds of prey. And one of our engineers said, why don't we call it something nice, like dove? And so that stuck. And so instead of launching a constellation of satellites, we're actually going to launch a flock of doves. This flock of doves will orbit the Earth. Like a giant ring.
It's up there now, isn't it?
It's up there right now, yeah. We're right in the middle of setting them up, actually, and taking the first pictures and testing out the system. So what they're going to do is basically act in concert in a ring around the Earth to take continuous imagery. That means that every 90 days we'll assemble a map of the entire Earth as it is in that season.
Now, they are going to operate at a relatively low orbit, is that right?
Yeah, so the first group that we put in space are in the same orbit as the International Space Station, so about 400 kilometers altitude. That means they last for about 12 to 18 months. By being really low, we can actually take pretty good images, but that comes at a cost of lifetime. The satellites will burn up very quickly.
And are they maneuverable? Can you say, look, I want the satellite, or perhaps several of them, to be in this place?
So we can move them around a little bit, but the idea is that they're all interchangeable. They're all the same. And so it doesn't matter which one takes a photo, and so they're continually swapping spots. But we can move them into position, and so to get the initial spacing in an even ring around the Earth, we want them about 30 degrees apart along their orbit. We need to move them apart.
Okay. So I guess most of us are familiar with images of Earth, which have been around for decades now. And of course, these days you can look at your street or your neighbor's extension on Google Earth.
Right.
What is different about what you're doing?
So if you look at most maps online today, pick your favorite mapping service online and have a look, the maps are a little bit funny. Some of them have weird pictures that are badly joined together, or they're a different color. Maybe in one picture the grass is bright green and the next one it's sort of a pale blue. Maybe you know, the left picture is snow because it's winter, and the other picture was taken 15 years earlier in summer. And so things don't really line up. What we'll be able to do is, with one type of camera, take all of the Earth without bias, with the same type of system essentially, and create a really smooth, clean picture that's not only looks great, that it's all very clean and joined together really well, but that it's actually very fresh. Nothing will be older than 90 days.
Right. So you'll, what, feed those pictures down to Earth continuously or every 90 days? How are you going to do it?
Yeah, so the cameras have about a 2 or 3 days worth of storage on board. And so we have about 6 locations around the world for ground stations where the satellites will downlink their imagery. So they're in continuous contact, essentially. You know, every 90 minutes or so, they'll send down a whole bunch of images. We'll collect those throughout the quarter and start assembling them. It takes us about a day to process a day's worth of imagery. So every 90 days, we should have processed the whole stack and be able to put it back out online.
What was it like? Because, as I said, it's only February, wasn't it?
Yeah.
When they were released from the Japanese part of the International Space Station.
That's right.
That must have been quite a moment for you.
Yeah, well, so one of the cool things about the space station is this is a brand new way to launch satellites, and it has some really nice benefits. So typically when someone launches a satellite, you put it on a rocket and it sits on the upper stage of the rocket. The rocket goes up. You have about 5 minutes. It's all on a timer. Happens very quickly. The satellites get popped off. They go into orbit and the rocket burns up. It's very quick. And there's usually no real contact other than some basic messages about what status, you know, single little strings, you know, deployment okay. There's no pictures sent back. This time we did something really different, which was we sent the satellites, all 28 of them, as cargo to the International Space Station, along with like pillows, blankets, food, and other supplies and spare parts for the station. So these were in a capsule that docked with the station around about January 9th.
You sort of FedExed them up.
We FedExed them up to the station, yeah. And so the astronauts, you know, opened the hatch, took all of the supplies out, put them in storage for about a month. And then at the start of February, they assembled a giant pack of these, of our satellites, into a large dispenser box, which basically is like a large canister with some barn doors on it that opened that pushed the satellites out. And they took that out of the hatch, of the out of the airlock of the space station, pointed it away from the station, and pushed a couple of buttons, and the satellites popped out. Now, the cool thing was that they were able to see it, and so they actually took photos for us. And so one of the astronauts, the Japanese astronaut Koichi Wakata, took photos with his handheld SLR camera of our satellites going into orbit. And so for the first time, we had high-resolution photographs of our satellites sitting above the Earth. You can see the blackness of space, the blue curvature of the Earth, and lots of clouds and ocean. And there are our satellites, if you can imagine, just poised gracefully like birds floating high above the sky.
That is way better than 5 minutes, isn't it?
It is. It was totally worth it.
So these images that they're going to be taking, and I know you're still kind of getting them all to work and to configure right and all that at the moment, and who's going to get those images? Who is your customer?
So right now we've got a bunch of large companies around the world that are really, really excited about this and see how much of a game-changing capability this is. So they've already signed up to buy our imagery before we've even got all of it down, which is really, really nice. But in addition to that, one of the goals of Planet Labs is to provide completely universal access to our images. And so we're going to be building a website where anybody can go and look and check out what they need to know. And if you want to start a business based on our imagery or use it in an application of your own, you'll be able to get very affordable access to the data.
How can you see it being used, this kind of very up-to-date Earth imagery?
So I guess it depends whether we're talking the first time we do it or the second time we do it. So the first time we'll take this base map. It's going to look really nice. You'll be able to compare against other maps and see things that have changed. But the other maps are mostly out of date. And so the first map, in a sense, will give us a snapshot of the world as it is.
It's a baseline, isn't
it? It's a baseline. So we call it the base map that we want to produce. So we'll produce the first base map. I think that'll have a really, you know, large number of applications in terms of measuring things on the Earth, like, you know, the number of forests. I have a goal by the end of the year, to the end of next year, sorry, to have counted every tree on the planet. Counted or surveyed and assessed how many trees we have. Then the cool thing is the following quarter when we produce another map, that's when it all starts and being able to see what's changed and go, well, hang on, this was forest 90 days ago. Now it's not. What happened? So that's the kind of the world I'm...
And when you've got, I don't know, maybe when you've got 20 quarters, it'll almost be like a video that you can look up of what's changing.
Yeah, so maybe, you know, in the future when you go to our maps website, we'll have a time slider. And instead of just looking at the Earth now, you'll be able to slide forward and backwards in time and say, well, you know, I want to look at the Earth in winter in 2014. Tell me about that.
And how much detail will you be able to provide? So if, I don't know, say I'm a farmer and I want to look at what's working and what isn't working. I already know a lot of that stuff, but you can give me images that can help, can't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we have on the cameras, we have color imagery. So red, green, and blue pixels. We also have near infrared, which is not visible to the human eye, but it turns out plants are very bright. They emit a lot of near infrared light. And so by comparing the near infrared channel and the red channel, you can learn about biomass and you can understand how plants are growing. So if you have your field and you're experimenting with watering two fields in a different way, where are you going to get the information on the results? You don't want to wait a whole growing season to find out, well, this field did poorly, this one did great, or I'm overwatering. If we could actually give you freshly updated information and you could say, well, I'm seeing the effect in real time of what I'm doing here. There's more life growing here because of my, you know, I've watered it the right amount. You'll be able to adjust your behavior and maybe increase your crop yields.
On Sunday Profile, I'm Richard Adey, and Chris Boshausen's my guest. He's an Australian physicist, originally from Tumbarumba, which is, if you don't know, it's a small town on the edge of the Snowy Mountains. He's still in his 30s. He's set up a company that puts lots of small satellites into space and sends frequent images back. Chris, I have to ask, because it is a long way from Tumbarumba to NASA and now what you're doing in San Francisco. When you were a kid, Were you always interested in space?
As far as I can remember, I have always been interested in space, and my mum verifies that. So, you know, she talks about me, you know, watching space movies when I was four, building shuttles and things out of Lego, and generally just always been obsessed with space and robots and the solar system.
I suspect you would have stood out, Tumbarumba. I mean, it's a small place. It's going to be very interested in sport, and you're interested in space.
Yeah, it was a little unusual growing up there. I, you know, always felt a little bit like I was an alien, and so maybe space was the natural place for me to go towards.
And were you encouraged? Was there a teacher, or was it your parents that said, "Look, you're really into this, and you're clearly very clever. Go for it."
I mean, my parents were always very supportive, and they would always indulge me when I brought out various Lego models of crazy things I've built, and it was a really very supportive household. The teachers actually at Tumbarumba High School were amazing, and I don't think I'd be where I was today without, you know, their support and interest, and particularly in physics. There was a teacher, Mr. Barrett, who really fostered my interest in physics and kept me going to do my degree ultimately in physics.
And your mum and dad, do they get to see what you do now?
Well, I'm hoping to send them pictures from space of their house.
Really? And so, yeah, you went from Tumbarumba High off to Sydney Uni to do physics. And is that when you became interested, because it's not just the physics, you became interested in things like space policy and space law, such as we have?
Yeah, so I think I've seen this a lot with many of my peers, is when you want to go to space, the first thing you think is, well, if only NASA had more money, or if only Australia had a space agency, all our problems would be solved. And so I went through a sort of career progression where I first started trying to advocate for an Australian space agency for a brief period of time. There was a little bit of interest in that. The astronaut, who's an Australian, Andy Thomas, wrote a letter to the federal government advocating their participation in the International Space Program. So, you know, I jumped on that bandwagon and really tried to stimulate activities here. When I traveled abroad, I did the same, trying to help with, you know, European policy on space exploration, helping NASA strategically as well. But I began to realize that, what were we waiting for? Why wait for somebody else to do it? And having spent, I guess, almost 8 years trying the policy and law angle, I realized that technology spoke for itself, and that you didn't need someone's permission really to do things. You didn't need someone else to set up an agency for you. You just had to do it. And the accessibility to hardware like smartphones or other, you know, high capability computers that are everywhere right now, technology is a great equalizer. And like I said earlier, if you wanted to build a phone-based satellite yourself and launch it into space, you could. And it's just crazy to think about that.
Do you think you would have got to that, I suppose, philosophical position if you'd stayed in Australia? Because this, it seems to me, is part of that kind of entrepreneurial, let's give it a go thing that seems particularly important in Northern California.
Well, I don't think Northern California was particularly, not necessarily the most important thing, but the biggest impact in my life has been meeting like-minded people. So I think one of the sort of secrets for me of really getting started and figuring this out was finding people, no matter where they were from, who were interested and motivated to solve the same problem. And for us to, you know, in moments of doubt or, you know, anxiety about, were we doing the right thing, for us to back each other up.
So with Planet Labs, which is only, is it even 3 years old yet? It's still a new business.
Yeah, we started at the end of 2010, 2011.
Yeah, all right. It can't be cheap building, coming up with these satellites and then building them. How's it all being funded?
We're a venture capital backed company, and we have investors who have, we were quite lucky to find investors who had already invested in space companies before. Elon Musk has his company SpaceX, as well as some other huge successes like Tesla and SolarCity. And so our first investors were actually investors in SpaceX, and we were their second space investment. I guess they had an appetite for space and understood the risks.
And so enthusiasm and knowledge and a tolerance of risk.
Yeah, I think most investors wouldn't be able to assess a space company initially, and it might seem, well, you know, the risk might be too high for them. But having already invested in a couple of other space companies, they were like, wow, this is great.
Didn't you get a Russian investor, already a billionaire, who was very comfortable in that milieu?
So recently, yes, we had Yuri Milner sign up.
I've heard of him, yeah.
He's one of Facebook's largest investors and has recently joined us as well. So very excited to have Yuri on board.
Right. And does this mean, he says cautiously, that you're now a rich young man?
I am not.
No, you must be.
Not yet at this point. I mean, you know, I have stock in the company, but, you know, it's all paper stock at the moment. And until we really do what we said we wanted to do, we're not worth anything.
So. Right. So... At some stage down the track, hopefully, fingers crossed, you will be.
Well, I guess so. But knowing me, I'll probably spend it all on space exploration anyway. So there's a saying in the industry, how do you make $1 million in space? Well, start with $1 billion.
So is this something that you want to do yourself, get into space?
I think going to space has always been my goal. But it's hard to solve that problem. Just if you start to do it, it's just very hard. Where's my rocket? Where's my life support systems? Where's my crew? And so Planet Labs for me is a way to start playing in the space industry and build an awesome team, build a portfolio of technology, and maybe have some cash to help really do the next big thing as well.
You love what you do, don't you?
I do. I really love it.
And it's not just solving the technical problems. It's the whole thing. It goes back to being a kid in Tumbarumba.
Yeah, it's I really can't tell the difference. I'm just, you know, whether it's building Lego satellites or building real ones, it's just fun to sit down and play and assemble things and see things work for the first time.
And you're connecting with other people, younger people, not as far along the track as you, so undergrads basically in Australia, and getting them over to America to kind of play in the same sandbox, is that right?
Actually, Richard, I have a great story about that. So I came to, I talked at University of Queensland about 2.5 years ago, and all of the students were amazed that I'd been to NASA because they had sort of believed that it was impossible for foreigners to end up and work at NASA. So I told them it was really, you could do it. And part of my advice was, you know, just get over there. Don't apply from here because no one will pay you any attention. Just go there. And so then after I left and started my company, we had an intern posting for an intern to work with our company. Mm-hmm. And I was out of town at the time, but this young Australian boy showed up and applied for the internship. And he said, well, by the way, do you know someone named Chris? He said to my two co-founders, and they're like, yeah, he works here. And it turns out he'd seen my talk at the University of Queensland, followed my advice, moved to Berkeley, walked down the hallway, seen an ad for our internship, and drove across the bay to San Francisco and applied for it, all based on a 3-minute thing I had said to him in a talk. So I was amazed at, you know, the impact that could have on someone's life, and, you know, completely transform the direction of his life.
Do you still have a sense of wonder about what's possible and what's already been achieved, or does solving the technical problems sort of take that away?
I don't think it ever wears off, Richard. It's always exciting. There's always more to solve.
Well, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Chris Boshausen is Chief Technology Officer for Planet Labs and this year's winner of the Advance Global Australian Award. If you want to see some of the photos he's talking about, the satellites he calls doves, go to our website. While you're there, you can comment on the program or set up the podcast. You'll find it at abc.net.au/Radio National. Sunday Profile is produced by Belinda Sommer. I'm Richard Adie. I'll be back next week.